Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
That's right, Joel. This is our Ask How to Money episode where every other Monday we answer five listener questions. And this week we've got five great ones, including a question about tuition reimbursement, the best way to go about that, a question about some different new bank account bonuses, and also when paying off your mortgage early does not make sense.
We've
got those three plus a couple others here on this episode.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. I think we got some good ones, and just ones that are highly applicable to most of us. So a lot of good questions that we're going to get to on this episode,
plus a couple others that may not be as applicable, but are still very good.
Yeah, still interesting for sure. I think sometimes I'm fascinated by the variety of questions that come in.
Oh yeah,
because
it's the spice of life.
Even if it's not something that I have dealt with personally, like I know that someone who has, and I can just kind of think of it as building a robust amount of financial knowledge. And I'm just curious, and I think a lot of our listeners are too. They're just curious about money in general, and hopefully the stuff we cover here just leads to you being like smarter when it comes to money in general. But Matt, before we get to that, you don't like to go to the doctor. You don't like to go to the dentist.
That is true. Although I'm trying to fix all of these things.
I know, yeah, you actually have gone recently, and you actually went to the eye doctor recently, which I was surprised to hear that you decided to make that move.
Yeah, I'm going to share this story with folks. And so I've been tempted to not go to the eye doctor, and you know this, but I know I've needed to go because my girls will point out that I can't read the clock that is on the stove. And here's the thing. It's in blue lettering. It's not very bright. It is hard to see, but they still make fun of me. And they're like, you can't read that when we're sitting at the table.
It's like, old man, get out of here.
It has made me realize, though, that I think my eyes have gotten worse over the years. It has been 12 solid years since I had gone and gotten my eyes checked. But I was tempted to, instead of actually go to the eye doctor, to just hop on Zinni and slightly tweak my prescription and making it a little bit stronger. Because basically,
it's like a frugal or cheap conundrum. You're like,
yes, yeah.
Do I pay the money to go to an eye doctor, or do I just assume that my vision has deteriorated a little bit?
Well, I know
and
it
just
has.
Like pad the numbers, right?
Exactly. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to make it a little bit stronger. I'm going to order those. I can avoid the going to the eye doctor altogether. But in the end, I decided, okay, I think that would be cheap. Like that would 100% be an instance of me
maybe you luck out
doing what I should be doing, which is actually going in and seeing the eye doctor, because they check for other things in your eye while you're in there as well, making sure. I don't know what they look for, but they just...
Oh, you got to fly in there, man. Like, you got to pick that out.
Just make sure that there's not other, weird stuff going on. So that was the decision that I make. And here's the thing. I am so glad that I did, because I went in and I don't have, eye cancer or anything like that.
That's
like,
good.
Nothing terrible, which I was actually a little bit worried as I was sitting down. I was like, oh, man, it's been over a decade. Like, I might have some screwed up eyes. But it turned out they're healthy, but they have gotten worse. But specifically, we discovered that I have an astigmatism in both of my eyes. And what that means is that there is something different that you have to do to your eyeglass prescription. You can't just make it stronger. You have to do something, it's like another set of numbers that you have to make an adjustment for.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad that I actually went in, because had I not gone in and had I just made my prescription stronger, I would have, A, not improved my vision, because it wouldn't have been the right correction. B, there's a good chance my eyes would hurt because I would be constantly straining because I hadn't corrected my eyes. I hadn't corrected my prescription in the correct way. And I would have been out the money, like the $30 or whatever that I would have spent on Zinni, because that's where I'm going to... Actually, I ordered some earlier this morning before we started working.
Oh, there you go.
Got me a new set of eyeglasses on the way from Zinni Optical.
The right ones that are going to, help your eyes.
Yes. And so I'm so looking forward to not only being able to see properly, but I'm just glad I made the right decision in this case, because like you said, I can be a cheap buddy and avoid doing the thing I think I need to do in order to save a couple bucks. And in this case, I'm glad I made the right decision. So the lesson here, don't self-diagnose any ailments you might have. Instead, actually go in and spend I spent like $80 getting my eyes checked, and she gave me the prescription, and now I know I'm set for another 12 years.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not terribly expensive. Hopefully not 12, but that's the thing is it's not terribly expensive to go to see an eye doctor. Usually you can get that appointment for $70, $80.
It's not that much.
It's really not too bad. And then, save on the back end when it comes to the the glasses that you're getting, because that is where most people fork over the most money. They'll drop $300, $400, $500 on prescription lenses, as opposed to going to a place like Zenni, mm-hmm. where you went, which is dirt cheap, but still just as good a quality. And they've got some cool styles too. So
I love their glasses. I'm actually really excited. I've got these kind of gray, clearish colored ones, so the frames are kind of a little more transparent.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking forward to trying out some new frames. I thought about getting some of like the hip wireframe. I don't think I can pull this off, though. I
mean, my dad, he went and got his at Warby Parker. That's another good choice. Those are a little more expensive, but they're still cheaper than going to a lot of the traditional eyeglass shops. So once you get that prescription, once you've had that eye exam, once you've not cheaped out on that, then you can like kind of sort of cheap out on the glasses. get the right prescriptions, right? But don't necessarily like overdo it and spend bukus of bucks for the frames.
Especially with younger kids too, we're wrestling around. Often, I don't know how many times I've gotten smacked in the side of the face or had them kind of wrenched off.
Usually
my
that's
face.
Me though.
when we're wrestling, that is true.
I mean, before we podcast every time.
Got to get that heart rate up to that target heart rate. Make sure that we are podcasting at the optimal levels. Joel, let's go ahead and introduce our beer this episode. This is one by Burial, and it is called Beneath the Tides of Relative Impermanence. I don't really have anything else to say. We'll talk about this beer and our thoughts on it at the end of the episode.
Maybe we should let the folks at Burial name our podcast episodes. That'd be kind of fun to see what they come up with.
We don't want folks to get depressed, though, just by reading the name of our episodes. We want them to actually click it and listen to
it. They have the most interesting beer names and sometimes depressing, but
they go deep.
Let's move on. Let's get to some listener questions. And if you have a question you want to submit for Matt and I to take on an upcoming Ask HTM episode, we would love to hear it. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask. Simple instructions there. It's basically recording a voice memo on your phone and then emailing it over to us, and hopefully we'll get it on the next one. So, Matt, let's get to our first question of this episode. This one is about banking bonuses, how to score money by moving your dollars around.
Hi, Matt and Joel. I'm a longtime listener, and I really enjoyed your podcast on my runs during the pandemic. I'm retiring next week at 52, and I plan to spend a certain amount of time shuffling our cash reserve around to various high-yield savings accounts just to try to squeeze out a bit of extra interest without taking on additional risk. I found, though, that many online banks have a direct deposit requirement. Since I'll be retired and don't have an employer giving me a wage anymore, I don't have any way to meet this. What do you suggest? Is there some way for me to get around this direct deposit requirement, maybe by setting up some kind of deposit from my brokerage account or something like that? Would love to hear any solutions you might have for this issue. Thanks again.
All right, Matt, I like Jeff's question. I personally am not much of a runner, but when I am going on a bike ride, I sometimes listen to podcasts, sometimes listen to music, depending on kind of what I'm going for. If I'm a little more leisurely, it's usually a podcast. But what about you? Do you run to podcasts? Do you run to music? Do we actually pump people up enough for their workout?
I hope we do, actually. So big thanks to all of our runners and workouters. Is that the right term?
Probably not.
Out there. Here, I'll say this. I've had some issues listening to audiobooks and listening to podcasts while I run, because for my entire life, I've always used that as a time to kind of decompress, unplug. But lately, if I'm wanting to catch up on something, I'll, pop in an earbud, one ear, take off running. But here's the problem with that is I get so engrossed into the story or the podcast, the narrative essentially, that I won't always pay attention. I pay attention to traffic. There's no danger there, but I have an issue with not listening to my body as much. And so I'll start running and I realize like halfway through the run, I'm like, crap, my knee has been really hurting and I don't really pay attention to it because I'm completely tuned into what I'm listening to. Mm. I'm not really listening to my body as much. But to Jeff and all the other folks out there who can do two things at once, kudos to you, and we appreciate y'all listening. But Jeff, let's go ahead and answer your question. You're talking about basically trying to get around some of these direct deposit requirements. And we feel that this is a great approach. If you can snag those bonuses in order to get a high rate of return, we feel that that's probably the best method we know of to increase returns on your money that you aren't willing to risk in the market for money that you want to keep on hand, that you want to keep liquid. And the thing is not all banks require you to have a number of direct deposits in order to snag the bonus, but some of them definitely do. It's kind of annoying, but we understand why they do it. They know it's sort of like this it's a bit of a hassle. And so once you do get that direct deposit up and running, you got that money going into that account, you're far more likely to stick around as a customer.
They made it sticky. It's like a little web they've spun for you.
Yeah, and of course, you know, if you bank with them, you know, for the long term, there's a higher likelihood that you're going to maybe use their other products, like a HELOC, or maybe you'll go to them for a car loan, that sort of thing. So we understand why they do it, but it makes it annoying for us as consumers when we're trying to maximize our return.
Yeah, but let's talk about Jeff's specific situation, and he wants to get around these direct deposit requirements when he doesn't have a paycheck, and it's tricky, right? So it's even tricky for freelancers, Matt, right, who don't have a steady paycheck coming in, and they just get paid willy-nilly here and there by different clients at different times. But for everyone out there who does have W-2 employment, all you got to do is set up your direct deposit to go to this new bank, and boom, you're done. It was super easy. But yeah, Jeff, you said you're retiring next week at the age of 52, which, by the way, congrats.
That's cheers.
Very early retirement. We're very happy for you. But this doesn't apply to you since you're too young, but for our more mature listeners who are receiving Social Security benefits, that check actually from Social Security, it usually counts for requirements or promotions like this. That counts as a direct deposit. So yeah, if you're in that boat, then you simply switch the account that your monthly check goes into if that's the case. But again, Jeff's kind of in no man's land. He's stuck in this direct deposit purgatory, essentially. So, Matt, you have kind of one way, though, that he can get around these direct deposit requirements, sign up for a new account, and still get the bonus, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, Jeff's kind of in limbo. But for Jeff and other listeners out there who, you know, don't want to change what account their paycheck is getting deposited in, the next best method is to try using ACH transfers. And so ACH transfers stands for Automated Clearinghouse. And these are just the standard push or pull transfers that you should be able to initiate with any bank account. And here's the thing, too. This is going to be completely dependent on what bank you're attempting to open an account with and what their specific requirements are. But a lot of banks say that ACH transfers from a bank and just from regular old banks like Ally, Capital One, Discover, that they're completely legit and that they'll count as those direct deposits. There are some banks out there that will even count transfers from PayPal and Venmo. So it doesn't necessarily have to be this super official direct deposit from an employer like you're used to. That being said, it is worth reaching out to someone at the bank to see if that counts as a direct deposit ahead of time. You want to make sure that you're not wasting your time. But quite a few banks will count these ACH transfers similarly to a direct deposit, allowing you to still get that sign-up bonus or that higher interest rate from that account.
Yeah, and it's so easy to initiate an ACH transfer from one bank to another. You just have to make sure you link those accounts. And once you do, like, Matt, I'm always transferring money back and forth from one account to another. And so it's as simple as that, really, for most banks. They accept that as a direct deposit. And then, you know, Jeff will be qualified. He'll be able to get that bonus, which, in effect, equates to a massive return on his money, especially in the environment we're in with just incredibly low rates of savings. It's like those bank account bonuses are gold. it's a big deal. And speaking of that, Doctor of Credit is our favorite site for bank sign-up bonuses. They aren't usually as rich as sign-up bonuses for credit cards, but they can still be meaningful, you know, $200-$400 potentially for opening a new bank account and keeping it around for 60 to 90 days. The great thing is that opening a bank account, it's not as painful as it used to be. I specifically remember, Matt, actually doing one of these with one of the big banks back in the day, and that was a mistake for so many reasons. One, just going into the branch was a big pain. Trying to close that account at the end was frustrating. And
they make it super hard.
And of course, it's
they don't want you to leave.
One of the big banks, exactly. They're trying to make your life miserable as usual. But yeah, that's not the case. You're opening up an account online these days, and so for Jeff, it should be pretty simple to kind of bounce around to some of these different accounts, open one up, get the bonus, and kind of see whether he likes the product or not, and whether he wants to stick around. But I think this is a great strategy, very reasonable to increase your earnings on savings without taking on any additional risk. It just takes really a little bit of record keeping, right?
Sure.
Make sure you're keeping track of where your money's going. But other than that, it's usually just 10-15 minutes to open that new account, make a couple of those ACH transfers, and Jeff's going to be golden.
That's right. We've got several other questions that we're going to get to during this episode, like the ones we mentioned about tuition reimbursement when paying off your mortgage when that doesn't make sense, plus a couple others. We'll get to all of that right after this break.
All right, we're back from the break. We're still taking listener questions. This next one comes from a listener who's trying to find the right credit card for his daughter.
Hey, Matt and Joel. My name is Jason. I am 45. My wife is 44. We have good income-paying jobs, and we have three kiddos. Our oldest kiddo just started college, and we're thinking about getting her a credit card just so she can start building some credit score as well, just so that she has something to put her gas money on and expenses other than her debit card right now, so that she's a little bit more protected. Of course, mom and dad would be watching it, but she is very responsible for an 18-year-old, but we also don't want to allow the leash out too much on just opening the window for spending everything on a credit card. So I'm curious, do you have a credit card you would recommend for a young, new credit card holder? Thanks, and have a great day. Look forward to hearing from you.
All right, Jason, thanks so much for that question, and we are so glad to hear that this is something that is on your mind. We feel that now is absolutely the time to be doing this. We want you to get your daughter used to credit cards while she's, you know, relatively young, because here's the thing, she's likely going to make some mistakes, but since it sounds like that you're still maybe financially responsible for her, maybe she's still under your roof, you'll be able to help her learn those lessons on a much smaller scale instead of her learning them the hard way later in life when maybe she's less likely to have someone looking out for her. Basically, you want her learning those lessons with like tens and hundreds rather than with like thousands and ten thousands of dollars. Essentially, this is why Joel and I, like you and I, we both use GoHenry, which is an app for kids. We use them right now with our oldest daughters because, like our kids, they're going to use plastic to make purchases eventually in their life. And so our philosophy is, you know, why not get them used to using it while they're young and while we have the ability to guide them? But of course, GoHenry, it's a debit card system, but we feel that the same principles apply when it comes to them swiping that card and understanding that money is leaving their possession.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And I do think, Matt, like what you said, that there's no better time than the present because, yeah, as your kids get older, you have less and less influence. And Jason still has a lot of influence over his daughter right now. Like, he can help her figure out which credit card is best. And he can then, you know, they can look at her spending together and they can figure out where she's making mistakes, kind of help her hone how she uses it. So, yeah, I love the idea of not waiting and hoping that eventually when she's got her own place and her own job that she's going to figure it out and use it well. Like, let's make sure we impart those values and the knowledge now. I think, you know, one reason too to move forward with this is because credit cards are great tools. Like, we talk about that all the time, but like all tools out there, you run the risk of using them poorly and hurting yourself. Like, you can misuse a tool, right? You can use a hammer to bust through a pane of glass and it's like, dang it, I did the wrong thing with that, and you can cause a lot of trouble. But
it's effective, but
in the wrong way. And in this case, right, your credit score and your personal finances could be hurt in a big way if you don't use credit cards well. Like you mentioned, your daughter, she sounds like a responsible young woman, but you want to make sure that she understands that the credit card, it's not offering free money. I think oftentimes for college students, that's how they've gotten in trouble, is they were like, wait, how much is my limit? Cool, I guess that's how much I can spend.
I got $2,000 free just sitting there waiting on me.
Right, and it's like, that's not how that works. But really, it is so important for her to understand that she's spending her own money, not free money that someone's given her. And it's a shift in mindset that's important to foster, especially for young folks who are getting to that age where they're going to fly the coop. Those are like really important developmental years, and we still need the input of our parents in those years to kind of help us with some of those bigger life changes. And really, of course, the most important rule for anyone using a credit card that you need to impart to your daughter is that she must pay the balance in full at the end of every month, and to never buy anything, put anything on that credit card where she won't be able to actually make that happen.
Exactly. But, you know, once you get that straight, like, there are so many different reasons that we are fans of credit cards. Jason, you mentioned two of the biggest ones, you know, the ability to start growing your credit score, like that is huge. And the additional consumer protections they offer are great as well. There's a lot of peace of mind because that, you know, liability for fraudulent transactions is capped when you use credit cards. If you get scammed out of your cash, you know, regardless if it's physical cash or even, you know, from a debit card, you're out of luck. But if you get ripped off via a credit card transaction, you've got immediate protections built in. That card acts as a buffer. And of course, you know, there are so many other credit card benefits like sign-up bonuses that we won't get into. We've talked about those enough here on the show. But if you want to listen back to episode 386, we actually do a deep dive on the different credit card benefits that you aren't using. And so, you know, Jason, in your case, you know that this is something you want to get your daughter doing. But for everyone else out there who's thinking, maybe, I don't know, you've come from some other personal finance guys who advocate against using credit cards, we are all for it, assuming, just like Joel said, that you pay your balance off at the end of every single month.
In full and on time. That's right.
Yep.
And let's talk about something else, Matt. Another option to boost Jason's daughter's credit score is to make her an authorized user on your credit cards, Jason. And that's assuming you've got great credit, but we're assuming that you do because it sounds like you've got your money game together and you're listening to this podcast and you're asking a question. So I'm sure things are good with your credit score, but go ahead and check. And then you can sign your daughter up as an authorized user. You can list her as an authorized user on one or two of your credit cards, and that will really quickly benefit her credit score. It'll make it look like she's been responsible, as responsible as you have to the credit bureaus, which is pretty cool. How you can kind of do that and grandfather your daughter into your good credit standing in that way. So yeah, consider that. And then work towards getting a card of her own too. And then kind of, well, what's the best credit card to get? That question is the next one that pops up. Well, that really depends. And actually before 2009 and the introduction of the Card Act, the world was kind of the college kid's oyster. You know, banks were offering credit cards like candy on campuses. We've heard stories, Matt. I remember back in the day we had J.D. Roth on, and he talked about what was a free pizza. Is that what he got? Or did you get a free pizza?
I got a free pizza.
What did he get? He got a Frisbee, I think. Yeah. And so that was kind of like the way things went down, is banks were on college campuses offering credit cards to kids when they had to be able to prove zero.
Oh, yeah.
About their financial responsibility, their income, any of that stuff.
Well, even before that, I mean, my first credit card I got when I was a teenager living at home in high school. And at the point when I applied for that card and received it, I didn't have a job.
Yeah.
And so the laws have changed a lot since then.
You know what? We're podcasters. We still barely have jobs. But that was one of those things that it led to severe long-term debt problems for so many people. And so now, because of that, you know, legislation 12 years ago, if you're under 21 with no credit score, you have to have proof of income or a willing cosigner. And we'd suggest that you go in the student credit card direction for the time being until her credit score gets boosted to where she can get some of the better cards that Matt and I talk about that we prefer. Discover is probably the best in this area with their IT cards. Capital One Quicksilver Student is another great one with no annual fee, and it gets you 1.5% cash back. And then, yeah, once you've established, you can upgrade that credit card with one of those credit card companies, or you can just sign up for another credit card that is going to be better fit for her and for how she spends. But we'll link to both those cards in the show notes. We think they're two of the best for anybody in her position.
Yeah, one of the benefits of those student cards is the fact that oftentimes their limits are lower. And sort of like we said at the beginning of the episode, if she can make mistakes with just maybe hundreds instead of thousands and tens of thousands, I think that's one of the things to keep in mind, is that regardless of the card, it probably would be better for her to have a card with a lower limit. That way it keeps her out of trouble. I think another...
Prevent her from going in the Maserati dealership, you know?
Yeah.
Put this on my plastic.
And then the co-signing option made me think of the fact, too, it might be worth you proactively co-signing that card with her. That way you can, I don't know, maybe it's meeting once a month or just talking on the phone once a month to kind of go over some of her transactions, seeing where her balances are. And I think that could allow you to have a more active role in sort of the day-to-day operations of that specific credit card. And I don't know, like, this doesn't have to continue indefinitely, but man, after like 6 to 8 months, if she's doing a great job and just like you said, she's being incredibly responsible, that's something where maybe you check in like once a quarter, like once every few months, or like only at holidays. You're like, hey, how you doing with that credit card, by the way? Want to make sure you're paying off your balance every month. And hopefully you'll hear the great news that, like, yep, you know, paying it off every single month, where she's almost treating it like a debit card, but getting all of those sweet credit card benefits.
No doubt. Jason, best of luck to you and your daughter. And, I mean, yeah, it's a big time leaving the nest like that. So congrats to you and her.
Does that get you thinking like 10 years from now?
I'm just going to like purposefully make sure my kids fail at school so they have to continue to stay home with me, because I like hanging out with them.
Let them fly.
All right, let's. I'm sure I'll feel that way at some point. But let's get to the next question. This one is about rebuilding your finances after filing for bankruptcy.
Hi, Matt and Joel. I'm generally a financially smart person, and I have a strong financial history, but I made the horrible mistake of allowing my former husband to have complete control over our finances, and as a result, we went through a bankruptcy. We are now divorced, and our bankruptcy is finally discharging. My credit score has taken a major hit, of course. What steps would you recommend to begin to rebuild my credit as efficiently as possible? Thanks for everything.
All right, Matt, by the way, that question was from Becky, and a really tough question. And Becky, I'm so sorry to hear about the financial, the relational, and the emotional turmoil that you've gone through recently. That sounds like a lot, and I think it's important. I'll just want to speak from personal history for a minute. Like, I want you to know that bankruptcy is not the end-all be-all. It doesn't define who you are, and it doesn't say anything about you as a person. And when I was a kid, my parents went through bankruptcy. I was about 12 years old. It was really, really tough on them. It was tough on my whole family, my siblings. But they made it out on the other side, and they're in a better financial situation than ever. Like, they're both just about on the precipice of retiring, and they're going to be able to do that in their late 60s, which I think in their 40s, they were like, we're going to work until we die. Like, that's what they assumed at that point in time. And so, yeah, I just want you to know that these things happen, and to not beat yourself up over it, because it's easy to do that and get into like that self-flagellation mindset. But really, let's talk about like what you can do moving forward, and let's not dwell on like the negative past mistakes.
Becky, for you, I think one silver lining is that it sounds like you know your stuff when it comes to personal finance. And so it's not like you're starting from, complete scratch on the knowledge side. And I feel like that's incredibly helpful. So, yeah, let's kind of talk about rebuilding here. That bankruptcy is going to stay on your credit report for 7 years, most likely. And that is going to impact your credit score. Although the further away that you get, the more that your score is going to start to improve, even before it is completely removed from your credit report altogether. So that's some additional good news. But in the meantime, there are some other things that you can do now to improve that credit score.
Yeah, it's important to do what you can to handle credit responsibly now. But getting that credit is tough when you have a bankruptcy on your credit report. So how do you get a credit card and actually start to do the hard work towards improving that score? Well, you might have to initially settle for a secured card. And the way that these secured credit cards work is that you put down a deposit at the bank, and that deposit essentially acts as your credit limit. There's no risk to the financial institution because if someone doesn't pay, they have the deposit to cover it. So let's say you open up a $1,000 secured credit card. You have to come to the table with $1,000, but then at the end of the day, you have this reporting to the credit bureaus that you have a $1,000 credit limit on this card. And then you want to, at the same time, make sure you're not using too much of that available credit, at most using charging $300 on that credit card each month, because you want to keep that what's known as the credit utilization rate low on that secured card. So it puts you in a tight spot. Like, you don't want to be using those credit cards necessarily at this point in time to fund all your purchases while it's a secured card. You want to keep the amount that you're using on it low.
Yeah, and something to keep in mind too when it comes to these specific cards is that, of course, like the typical credit card benefits that we talk about, that you'll often see with normal credit cards, they're going to be pretty meager with the secured cards. But there are some great options out there with no annual fees, like the Capital One Platinum Secured Card. And we can link to that one in our show notes. Amazon, they actually offer a similar credit builder credit card that we'll link to. And here's the other thing too. Joel mentioned coming to the table with $1,000 in order to provide that backstop, in order to essentially put down a deposit for your card. But for folks out there who can't spare the money, to put down that money towards a secured card, we would recommend Self, who actually used to be called Self Lender. And so we'll link to their site in the show notes as well. But they offer something that is known as a credit builder account, where you essentially take out a small loan from Self, and then you pay yourself back. That's why they call it Self. And so it's just about the easiest, and it's like, the safest way to build your credit score back up from scratch without having money up front. And then at the end of that period of time, once you've paid that money back, you've kind of got this nice amount of money sitting there in a CD waiting for you.
Yeah. Self, the product they came up with is genius.
It's pretty great. Yeah.
And it helps a ton of people out who have little to no credit score. And so I think it's a perfect, Becky, if she can do both, have the installment loan with self, have the credit card, the secured credit card, and, you know, having both of those things and making sure you handle both of those products well is going to help increase your credit score in a big way over time. And I just want to say a note to all the other How to Money listeners as well. It's so crucial. You know, Becky, it pained me to hear you say that you knew you know a lot about personal finances, but you kind of gave the reins completely over to your partner. And I'm sure looking back, you regret that. That's like you feel like that was a mistake. And I totally understand that.
In hindsight, your ex was an idiot. So,
right. Yeah.
We all know that now.
We empathize with you because that's incredibly difficult to have happen, to trust somebody and then to see them ruin that trust by, and you know, dissolving the marriage and then hurting your finances at the same time. But, you know, we want to just say that it's crucial to have both partners involved, at least to some degree, in financial decisions, in budgeting, and even if you trust your partner completely, which, you know, most of us feel like we do. And even if they're brilliant with money, like if, even though my wife like knows I've got a money podcast and we release 3 episodes a week, like she still has some...
My Joel, he's brilliant with money.
She still has a healthy amount of skepticism towards my, you know, some of my nuttier financial ventures. And so, yeah, she trusts me a lot and I do handle most of the investment decisions, but I always run them by her first. And she asks good questions that actually kind of help prod me in the right direction, maybe from away from doing something that's a little spur of the moment, because I'm kind of a go with the gut kind of guy. And so, yeah, her involvement is really, really crucial. She might not know all the questions to ask. She might not have as robust of a, when it comes to personal financial knowledge as I do, but that interplay, the way we help each other and the way we run things by each other is really important. So I just suggest that, like, it doesn't have to be an exact 50-50 split in couples, and it rarely will it be that. Rarely will you both be as passionate or interested or gifted when it comes to handling your personal finances, but I suggest a minimum split of 10 to 90%. So, and it's better if it's at least in that 20 to 80 range. So yeah, hopefully other listeners can hear that and apply that to their own, you know, marriages or partnerships. But Becky, you're going to rebuild. You've got the knowledge, and now you're going to take some of these steps, hopefully, when it comes to rebuilding your credit, rebuilding your financial situation, and we wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, and Becky, you know, one last thing too is we want to make sure that you don't have your credit score sit on this pedestal as like this be all end all of your worth. It's important certainly to build that back up, especially if you want to purchase a home in the future. But other than that, I mean, there aren't a ton of different reasons why you want to immediately rush as quickly as possible back into having a, you know, sky high, beautiful, perfect credit score. And so we don't want you just to completely go out of your way, pay lots of extra money in an attempt to rebound your credit score as quickly as possible. It's definitely something that we want you working towards, but at the same time, it is not that important, and oftentimes we can focus on these small technical things when instead maybe there are larger things like our career, our overall financial health that we should be focusing on. So it's important, but it is not the most important thing.
Yeah, and the great thing is time heals all wounds, really. Time heals credit score wounds. Time heals the emotional pain that's been inflicted, the damage that's been done. And it I don't think some of these things, like especially the emotional stuff, it never completely goes away. But it's amazing how you as humans, we're resilient. We can move forward. And so yeah, we wish that for you, Becky. All right, well, let's get to a couple more questions, Matt, including one about paying off a mortgage. Does it make sense? We'll get to that and more right after this break.
All right, we are back. We've got a couple more listener questions. And first, we've got one about this sweet little perk that an employer is offering.
Hi, Joel and Matt. This is Jen from Wichita. I have a question about how best to use my tuition reimbursement. I just started a 2 years master's degree program. I paid cash for the first semester this past summer, and I plan to pay cash for the final summer semester, but I'm borrowing for the spring and fall semesters. All told, it'll be about $14,000 that I borrow. My employer offers tuition reimbursement that is about $2,500 per fiscal year. When I get the reimbursement from this past summer semester, how's the best way to use this? Should I go ahead and pay against the first loan that I've already taken out, or should I sit on it until next year and borrow a lesser amount? Or does it matter? Is it six of one, half a dozen of the other? And then during my second year, when I get tuition reimbursement, should I pay that toward the first loan or the second loan, or split it in half and pay it toward both? Thanks.
All right, Jen, great question. What a great employer perk, by the way, Matt. And I love that we're seeing more and more of this. Like, employers are realizing, hey, student loans are a big problem for our workforce, and we're going to find ways to meet that problem by paying people money if they have student loans or if they're getting a higher education.
Even covering the cost of books.
That's solid.
I love
because
it.
Those books, we know they're not cheap. I know they're not cheap because I just bought some for Emily, but there are some ways around that. We've talked about that before. But I do love seeing employers investing in their workforce. And Jen, good luck with your schooling. Obviously, we love that you're able to pay cash for a lot of it and that you're keeping your borrowing to a minimum. This is going to serve you well in the future when you're able to, hopefully, after post-graduation, have a higher rate of pay and have very little money that you owe in student loans. That's the place to be.
That's right. So let's talk about what to do with this tuition reimbursement money. And we think that the best choice is to use that money to pay off any loans that you currently have right now. And that's because your grad school loans, they are accruing interest, like literally as we speak. The interest clock, it starts ticking right when that loan gets made compared to subsidized undergrad loans, right? Because that's not the case. Oftentimes that interest is paid by the government until you're out of school for a certain amount of time. And so for you, though, you are currently racking up interest. And so it's a whole lot more financially savvy to pay that lump sum directly against the loan that you currently have so that you can slash some of those interest costs immediately instead of keeping it in savings where you'll be earning next to nothing. We can't think of any benefit that would come from sitting on that money as opposed to putting it towards your loan now.
Yeah, Matt, I completely agree. And then the next tuition reimbursement that Jen asked about, well, we would say that should go towards paying off whichever loan has the highest interest rate. It's likely that it'll be the most recent one too, because rates on federal student loans, they actually recently went up.
That's
in July, right?
Yeah. Right?
There's something by about a point. So
yeah.
I think graduate student loans are like 5.25. They used to be 4.25. So when it comes to paying off that debt, this would be considered the debt avalanche since you're ranking them by interest rate.
You're looking at the numbers.
Exactly.
Specifically the interest rate.
And they're probably, you know, similarly sized loans. But if there's a big enough difference in the two loan amounts, you could also take the size of the balance into account and you could pay down the smaller loan, which is the debt snowball approach. But yeah, the balances are probably close and the, you know, interest rates aren't too dissimilar, but focus on the one with the higher interest. You know, get after that one and make sure that one is all the way gone before you move on to the next one. That's the way we'd prefer you to go after it, by mathematically paying the least amount of interest possible.
And one other thing to consider too, if your balance is manageable, maybe you should refinance that federal loan into a private loan, since it sounds like you're really intentional with your money and it sounds like your balance is relatively small. Jen, for you, it could make a ton of sense to refi with a private lender. You can score a lower rate and then you can pay that loan off more quickly.
So much harder to do if you have a $100,000 balance, but if you've got $12,000 in student loans and you feel like that's manageable within your budget, refining and getting a lower interest rate can make a whole lot of sense.
It's a bit more feasible. You know that you're going to be paying that entire balance off. And so it's a matter of how quickly can you pay that balance off.
Right.
Yeah, we've actually got an article up on the site on refinancing student loans. And we'll make sure to link to that in our show notes.
Yeah, former guest of the show, Megan Landris. She is a CSLP, Certified Student Loan Professional. And that means she's an expert. And so she wrote a great article up there, and we'll link to that in the show notes, just about when it makes sense to refinance and where it makes sense to go when you're considering refinancing, shopping the rates. Just a little teaser out there is the best way to go. It's so easy to do now on the interwebs. But let's get to the next question for this episode, Matt. This one is from listener John, and he's kind of ready to be done with mortgage payments.
Hey guys, this is John in Asheville. Love the show and the beer recommendations. If you guys are ever in town, I'd love to buy you a beer or three at my favorite craft brew spot, Jackalope Brewery. Wanted to get your thoughts about using my emergency fund and a HELOC to pay off my mortgage and then keeping the HELOC around as my emergency fund until I'm able to replenish that fund. I have about $50,000 remaining on my mortgage. We have a 4% rate, and with escrow, we pay about $1,700 a month. About 39-40 payments left. I have $30,000 in my emergency / savings account, and again, barely earning any interest. The only other debt is a Costco Visa that I pay off monthly. I got to get those rewards, and I max out my 401k and both my wife and my IRA each year. The HELOC is prime plus 0.25, and today's prime is 3.25, but it does have a floor of 4%, so it's as equal as my mortgage. I just want to get your thoughts. The risk there, if no emergencies come, it will be great. It will work out just fine unless the Fed moves that prime above 3.75. So love to get your thoughts. Thanks.
Matt, John's rolling with one of my favorite credit cards.
So I've got to get that Costco Visa because, I mean, you can't really beat the 4% on gasoline purchases. And what is the cash back also in Costco stores?
2%.
Yeah.
So. And now that I've officially brought you into the cult that is Costco, I think you have to go all the way and now get the credit card.
Well, I probably will. I feel like I've gotten more targeted with my different credit cards. And so, yeah, we might have to make an update to the different credit cards that we use. Hopefully it's not 100% overlap between you and me. But John, first of all, I got to say, I appreciate your dislike for debt. The desire to get rid of your mortgage and to do so more quickly, it's a really good desire. In a recent episode, we actually talked about using a HELOC as a backup to an emergency fund. And we do think that that is a reasonable and not too risky of a move that can help people to accelerate their ability to invest a little bit more, especially with the meager returns that folks are seeing on their savings accounts right now. And so we're cool with that. But one thing that we didn't hear much about in your specific question, actually, was how your investments are doing. Because it's probably better, at least from a financial return standpoint, to invest more than it's going to be to accelerate that mortgage payoff.
Yeah, we don't know how his investments are performing, but my guess, it sounds like John is doing a good job when it comes to putting money aside in his investment
accounts. He's at least maxing out his retirement accounts.
Right. And to me, that says a lot. But let's talk about why investing more makes sense. It's for a few reasons. First, your mortgage rate. It's relatively low, 4%. It doesn't look as good as it used to with rates continuing to slide, but it's still really solid. Secondly, your balance is incredibly low, John. And since you're so far along in that loan, you're not paying all that much in interest because you got most of that all out of the way already. Like when you look at how much money is going to the interest versus the principal, it's a lot of money towards the interest at the beginning of your loan. And it's way, way less. It's so much going towards principal at the end. And you're on the tail end, which means that most of your money is not going towards those interest payments, right? And that makes it less helpful to actually rush to pay it off. So going through these steps in an attempt to technically be mortgage free, while it might make sense from an emotional standpoint, it's not necessarily the best move when you're looking at the numbers. We'd rather see you pay that mortgage off over the next 39 months, as agreed, and increase the money that you're investing instead because of how favorable the terms are at this point for you.
Yeah, the way the amortization schedule works, John, basically you're paying like pennies on the dollar right now.
Right. Can you say amortization three times fast, Matt?
Amortization.
All right, that's not bad.
It did sound different when I said it three times fast. But John, I mean, seriously, so little money right now is going towards interest that even though technically you do have a 4% mortgage, you are effectively paying way less than 4% currently,
right,
for these last 39 payments. Like, for a 30-year mortgage, actually, there's like this tipping point, and it's not until about year 7 where the money that you're putting down that's going towards your balance is actually more than the amount that's going towards interest. And obviously, you are well past that 7-year mark, well, assuming that you have a 30-year mortgage. But John, this is definitely something important to keep in mind for you. And the other thing, too, is that, I mean, basically, John is in money year 7, right? Like, he and his wife, like, they are maxing out their retirement accounts. They've got a great emergency fund in place. Their mortgage is not going to be around for much longer. Really, they could probably go in any direction that they want from here. All the options are great. The world is their oyster. And so, John, if you have a desire to invest more of that money, we'd say to open up a brokerage account and start investing more. If you want to pay off your mortgage instead, you want to go hard in that direction, that's fine too, if you want to kind of feel some of those emotional wins. But going the HELOC route to do so just doesn't make sense mathematically based on where you are within the life of your loan. For your case specifically, we would say that you just err on the side of simplicity rather than going down the path of opening that HELOC.
Yeah, no doubt. But John, seriously, there are so many options available to you. 39 months left on your mortgage is incredible. And the fact that you're going to be able to pay it off in a whole lot less than that, if you want to, is really cool. And that's a big financial win. But jumping through hoops and potentially paying more to the banks by opening a HELOC just doesn't make sense for you, we don't think. But the cool thing about being in money gear 7, Matt, we've talked about this, is that you can start to spend more. You can start to give more money away. There's so many options when you get to this point. And so I want John to think a little bit bigger than just like paying off the mortgage in as rapid a fashion as possible. Like, start thinking, John, about what you want your life to look like and how you want to funnel the vast amount of money you've been able to save over time, especially without having a mortgage. You're going to have more room in your budget. Where do you want that money to go? Those are good questions to start asking now.
Yeah, over the next 3 years, that's going to be hopefully plenty of time for you to kind of start thinking about what your life is going to look like.
Right, for sure. All right, Matt, let's get back to the beer that we had on this episode. This one, of course, had a weird name because it was brewed by Burial Brewing, and this one's called Beneath the Tides of Relative Impermanence. It's a double IPA. What were your thoughts on this one?
Well, I've got to say that I feel this is just as delicious now here in a can as it was in person on draft. Kate and I, we picked up this beer back when we took a little anniversary trip up to Asheville, North Carolina, one of our favorite little kind of getaway cities to head off to. But dude, this was such a good New England style double dry hopped IPA. It had so much of that sharp, hoppy funkiness going on that we so often look for when it comes to these different New England style IPAs. And so, yeah, I'm not going to talk about the tasting notes as much, but it's just definitely, there's a good reason why this is a go-to style for both you and I. And instead, I kind of want to focus on the can art because their art is always pretty awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
This one's like Salvador Dali-esque.
Yes.
And I was going to say, actually, speaking of art, Matt, this beer was almost like a work of art. It was that good. And you know how when you see something that's like amazing hanging up on the wall and you're kind of speechless? I think that's why you didn't have a lot of tasting notes. Why? And same here. I'm like, it was just that good. Like when you experience something that's close to nirvana, close to perfection.
Perfection.
Yeah, this beer was that. And so I don't have much else to share either on the way it tasted. Like the art looks amazing. I love what the Salvador Dali piece, the persistence of memory or whatever. And this one definitely had that vibe. And
got the melting clock action going on there on the label.
And the beer just kind of melted in your
mouth. It's phenomenal. Basically, we should just quit while we're ahead.
Right, yeah. All right, so we will quit for today. And if you have a question that you want to... Yeah, for Matt and I to take on an upcoming Ask Kind of Money episode, we would love to hear it. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask, submit it there, and yeah, hopefully we'll take it 2 weeks from today.
We'll go ahead and wrap this one up so you can get to the next podcast episode that you're going to listen to, but look us up on Instagram if you haven't recently. We're going to try to share some more personal stuff like we've been doing over the last couple weeks. You can find us there under the username of HowToMoneyPod. Joel, that's going to be it, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.